Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Xfinity Mobile, featuring customized wireless plans. Customers can choose unlimited, buy the gig, shared data, or a mix of both and switch it up anytime. Learn more at xfinitymobile.com.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Health Dialogues. On today's show, addiction in all its forms. From cigarettes to methamphetamine, alcohol to crack cocaine, substance abuse takes a huge toll.
I had gotten pregnant and had a miscarriage. And while I was having the miscarriage, I was sitting in there smoking crack.
There's often a genetic predisposition to addiction, so it can run in families. And when parents just can't kick their habit, what happens to their kids?
We have toddlers that pick drugs up off the carpet and end up in the emergency room full of methamphetamine or PCP or other dangerous drugs, and there's calls to the authorities.
Coming up, the human costs of addiction and how all of us pay the bill for treating addiction in local emergency rooms. I'm Scott Schaefer, and this is Health Dialogues. And welcome back to Health Dialogues. I'm Scott Schaefer. Addictions come in so many forms, from the injection of heroin to abuse of prescription meds, from chain smoking to compulsive sex. And addiction can affect anyone from homeless people down on their luck to corporate executives and suburban teenagers.
I lost respect from any and everybody. I was just out there by myself and hustling and bustling and selling my body and doing anything I can to get the drug.
Addiction to me is sort of like having an argument and the argument having you instead of you having the argument at some point.
And for me, the addiction was basically my main motivation. And living in the streets with my daughter, and at that time she was about 3 or 4 when we were living there and living in our minivan. So we call it city camping.
My name's Jason. My addiction was to alcohol. I'd consider myself normal, middle-class male. Starts kind of in the back of your mind like a hunger or thirst, and it just nags at you.
When I was under the influence of crack cocaine, I felt like I could do anything. On it, I felt like I could conquer the world. I could go out and be anything and anyone.
I've tried to get clean through my addiction several times, but I was always faced with a dramatic amount of pain in my life, which kept me using.
I'm addicted to cigarettes. I find that when I'm stressed out, I smoke, and I tried quitting. It's not that I don't know these things are bad. I know they're bad, and I know that I need to change my behavior. I'm just not ready to do it.
That was Bobby Jordan, Antoinette Fort, Albie Park, Carrie Hamilton, Ramona Shule, Jason, and Lloyd, talking about their struggles with addiction. This hour, we're looking into the physical, psychological, and financial costs of addiction and substance abuse, and we begin with Steve Shoptaw, psychologist and professor in the UCLA departments of family medicine and psychiatry. I asked him for a definition of addiction.
Addiction is a neurobiological disorder that's expressed behaviorally. What that means is it's a brain disease. Its genesis is in the brain, but it leads to a set of behaviors that are common across people that define addiction. These are things like using more drug than you thought you were going to use, having a hard time quitting, having a tolerance or withdrawal for a substance. Those are physiological symptoms. And then, of course, one of the most defining features is continued use despite knowledge of negative consequences.
And do different people have different reactions to those doses? I assume they do.
They do. There are dramatically different reactions to substance over time. Some people will, say, smoke a first cigarette and then feel sick and never taste it again. Others have a buzz and they think, wow, this is great. And their experience of this of the substance is different, and so is their behavior.
And so is there any way to predict which of those things is going to happen to somebody?
Studies show that there is a strong heritability of addiction-related problems. We find that in alcoholics, that there's a high likelihood that if you have an alcoholic man, that his father was also an alcoholic. It's not as strong a relationship among women, but it's still there. If addiction and major depression is in your family, that's a real code, a cue to you that your odds for having addiction as an adult are probably higher than your peers who don't have family members with addiction or depression in the family.
But it is accurate to say that some of these addictions or alcoholism runs in families.
Absolutely.
When you look at California and all the different kinds of drug dependencies and uses of substances that are regulated or that are illegal, what are the biggest problems?
We in California have a very unique place in the country. We have probably the highest prevalence of methamphetamine use across the country. Methamphetamine accounts for the number one reason for Prop 36 referrals. It also is, in Los Angeles County, the number one reason why people seek publicly funded treatment for substance abuse.
And we should just say Prop 36 is the measure that sends people into treatment rather than into prison.
That's right. Hot on the heels of methamphetamine, though, is misuse of prescribed medications or prescription pill dependence. People who use analgesics like Vicodin, OxyContin, Xanax, those sorts of drugs. It's a continuing problem. I work in family medicine, and one of the major concerns of frontline primary care providers is the misuse of analgesics.
You said California is a big capital for meth. Does it vary a great deal by where you are in California? Is that more of a problem, say, of rural parts of the state?
We have some data analysis that we did on emergency rooms from all of the hospitals throughout California looking to see where the people were getting into trouble around methamphetamine and when they sought help, where they were located. And we compared this to people who were using cocaine. What we found was that across California, there is a high and prevalent appearance of people in the emergency departments under the influence of methamphetamine or seeking care for methamphetamine-related injuries or overdose. And that happens in rural and urban areas across the state. We like to think of it as that methamphetamine evenly dusts California from rural to urban. This contrasts with cocaine, where we find cocaine-related admissions to the emergency department being concentrated in the four urban areas of California, in the San Francisco Bay Area, in Los Angeles, San Diego, and in Sacramento. So in the outlying areas, in the rural areas, there's not much crack. There's not much cocaine. But there's plenty of methamphetamine.
You know, we hear people use the word addicted in ways that may or may not be accurate. Like people will say, well, I'm addicted to coffee, or I'm addicted to shopping, or I'm addicted to video games. I mean, is that a completely different thing when it physiologically or psychologically than these other things you're describing?
The correct answer to that is no one really knows whether they're all variants of the same thing or not. So some people are starting to think, though, that things like gambling or shopping, as you mentioned, or video games, that these sorts of behavioral addictions, another one that's very popular right now is sexual addiction. There's a show on the cable channels about people with sexual addictions. So it's these are thought to be variants of the same sort of disorder as addiction to a substance, because the behavioral criteria that you use to define a substance-related addiction is very similar to the criteria that you use to define someone who has a behavioral addiction.
When you look at all these different kinds of addictions or dependencies, is there a sort of a common approach to treatment that seems to work better, or does it depend on what the addiction is?
Only a minority of people, about a third, will actually receive treatment for their substance-related disorders. So most people don't get treatment. Once you begin to look at what's in the treatment system, what you see is that things sort of fall out into two camps. One is medication-based treatments, and the other are behavioral or community-based treatments. So medication treatments are the best first line of treatment for people with opiate dependence. It doesn't matter whether you're talking about heroin or whether you're talking about prescription drug medication. The combination of medication approaches with behavioral therapies are also most appropriate for people with smoking-related disorders, tobacco addiction. Hmm.
And just how many people are we talking about? What percentage of Californians or Americans would you say have or have had some kind of a issue with addiction?
It's a high number. I work with primary care providers, and one of the first things I'll talk is and say is that 1 in 11 of the people in your waiting room meet criteria for drug dependence of one form or another, drug abuse or dependence. When you begin to think about the stratification of the society, then you can actually find even higher numbers in certain groups. People who have economic or healthcare disparities have higher rates of substance abuse or dependence. Certain sexual minorities, like gay men, often will have very high rates of methamphetamine abuse and dependence. And in Los Angeles and San Francisco, about 11 or 13%, depending upon where you are, of gay men will report using methamphetamine in the past 6 months.
And in fact, later in the hour, we'll be talking about that very thing. Steve Shoptaw is a professor in UCLA's departments of family medicine and psychiatry. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Substance abuse is damaging to the user, no question about that. But when the user is pregnant or a parent, there can be collateral damage to the fetus or to the user's family. The Homeless Prenatal Program in San Francisco helps low-income women, including pregnant women living on the streets, to beat their addictions and get their lives together. The program is housed on a busy street corner near the county hospital. Walk into the spacious lobby on any given day, and you'll find women and kids picking up bags of food, sorting through baby clothes, attending support groups, or waiting for their case managers. Homeless Prenatal helps around 2,700 families a year to become stable, whatever the challenge. Housing, mental health, addiction, anything that contributes to their living and struggling on the street. Carla Roberts is the Child Welfare Substance Abuse Services Coordinator here. I asked her to describe some of the things clients are confronting.
A lot of times the families are using substances to deal with pain, whether that's physical pain with medical marijuana or physical abuse that they've suffered or mental health issues around depression, bipolar, that sort of thing. They use drugs and they have been using them. And what we found is that a lot of the clients that come through here have used primarily from anywhere from 5 to 20 years consistently.
So what motivates someone at this point in their life when they come to you to finally kick it?
Most of the time it's their children being at risk of removal from Child Protective Services, or they have been removed. And so they themselves might have been brought up in the foster care system. And we've had a lot of families that have come through, have made a difference in their children's life by turning themselves around.
And if they're pregnant?
If they're pregnant, that's sort of difficult because, in two instances, if they're pregnant, they may say, oh, this is an opportunity for me to stop using. I have a baby now. I'm not going to get high. On the other hand, some women have not yet connected to that baby, and so until the baby gets here, and so addiction can continue throughout the pregnancy.
I would imagine that'd be really frustrating for you to see a woman who, and you know the damage that can be done to a fetus.
Mm-hmm. It is frustrating, but also no addiction, and addiction is very hard to kick.
Since being founded 20 years ago, the Homeless Prenatal Program has grown. It now helps families dealing with a wide range of issues. They host a variety of support groups, prenatal and parenting classes, Narcotics Anonymous meetings, and a peer parent support group for parents who are in the social welfare or criminal justice system and are working to be reunified with their kids. We spoke with one client currently in the program.
Hi, my name is Frances Greenwood, and I got here. My kid had got taken away, and Child Protective Service recommended that I come to Homeless Prenatal because I had a drug addiction, which was crack cocaine.
Frances Greenwood is 48 years old and the mother of four children, a daughter who's 24, and three sons, ages 11 through 20. Greenwood began using drugs in the 1990s when she was in her 30s.
When I first started using crack, I had two kids.
She got clean for nearly a decade, held a job at a bank, but around that time, she says she injured her neck and started using the prescription painkiller Vicodin. That triggered another round of addiction, and she soon went back to using crack cocaine.
I just wanted to get high. I can't blame it on anything. I can't pinpoint it. But one thing that I do know is that I wasn't connected to my peers that I was in the program with. I wasn't going to meetings. And I feel like if I stay connected now, it'll be a less chance that I'll go back out there.
What did that do to you as a parent? How did it change you?
I wasn't as close to my kids. I was like mainly pushing away or hurrying up getting them dressed to get out the house.
Because?
I wanted to do crack. You know, things was about me and not about us or them.
And how did you feel doing the crack?
I was really depressed. I really wanted to kill myself at one point. I had gotten pregnant and had a miscarriage. And while I was having the miscarriage, I was sitting in there smoking crack.
After that miscarriage, she continued using crack and had another son who's now 13. 2 years later, still using crack, she had another pregnancy, no prenatal care, and gave birth to her youngest son, who is now 11.
He's doing fine. He's doing great. You know, but if I feel like if I wouldn't have done crack with him, you know, he has ADHD, you know, and he's a handful. I just feel like a few problems that he have, it came from the crack cocaine.
Today, Greenwood is back in recovery, working with a case manager here at Homeless Prenatal.
I came here in November, and I lied in the beginning of saying that I was clean because no one had tested me. And so now I think I have like 6 months clean, 5 or 6 months clean. And I don't want to count how many weeks, days, months. I just want to count the years.
Frances Greenwood talks about addiction like a chronic disease, something she'll have to battle the rest of her life. And as program founder Martha Ryan explains, in treating substance abuse, success sometimes falls short of clean and sober.
Does that mean you have to accept a certain level of use?
Might have to accept a certain level of use. But if you can get them from using incessantly throughout the day, you can bring it down little by little. And once someone begins to feel better about themselves, their own self-esteem, their health, because they're not using as many drugs as they had been in the past, then this actually could be the impetus for them to go into full recovery. And so every little bit helps. To throw the baby out with the bathwater is sort of like ridiculous. You have to work little by little with people. And when you have so many triggers out there in the community, you're still poor, you don't know where you're going to sleep that night, you don't know how you're going to feed the children that you already have. These are triggers that women might want to, that might make women use drugs again, because it's just too hard. Many times people, women who have not made it, because part of recovery is slipping. And if they don't make it, they know. Sometimes they'll say, I felt embarrassed about coming back here, but they know that our arms are open.
No judgments.
No judgments.
And you can see photos from our visit to San Francisco's homeless prenatal program. Just go to our website, healthdialogues.org. While you're at it, you can also check out a visit to Skid Row in downtown Los Angeles by Shuka Kalantari. It's home to one of the largest homeless populations in the nation. At our website, you can take a virtual tour of Skid Row with an outreach worker who knows all too well what it's like to be addicted and homeless on the streets of L.A. Again, it's all at our website. Just go to healthdialogues.org. Homelessness and alcoholism often go together, and that's a big problem for California hospitals. That's because homeless alcoholics tend to be frequent users of emergency rooms at considerable cost. San Diego is one city that's trying to do something about it. From KPBS, Kenny Goldberg has the story.
It's another busy afternoon in the emergency room at UC San Diego Medical Center. Linda Beach is the ER case manager. She says there's a small group of patients that get the majority of the care here. Most of them are homeless alcoholics.
And on any given day, our 22 beds may be occupied by four or five. So, you know, roughly a quarter of our capacity is tied up with a chronically intoxicated person.
By law, emergency rooms have to treat anyone who comes through the door. Beach says the drunks usually just need to sleep it off, but one of them can tie up a bed for 4 or 5 hours. Beach says he's getting all too familiar with some of these folks.
I've had a guy who's been here 36 times since the middle of January. He's unfunded, so the hospital gets no reimbursement for that care, always brought in by medics. So it's a high cost to healthcare because it's always an ER, which is expensive, and medics, which is an ambulance transport.
How expensive is this habitual use of the ER? A study of some 500 homeless alcoholics found a pattern of constant ambulance trips and ER visits that racked up more than $17 million in charges in just 3 years. And they take up a lot of police and paramedics' time. The San Diego Police Department is trying to do something about it.
Do you want to go into a rehab program?
What is a rehab program?
On a street in downtown San Diego, police officer Timothy Burns tries to interest a man in getting sober. Burns is with the department's homeless outreach team. Each HOT team has a police officer, a clinician, and a county benefits worker. They drive up and down the streets in an old black and white van. Their mission? To contact chronic alcoholics on the street and urge them to go into treatment. Sergeant Rick Schnell oversees the program. He says 50% of police calls in the downtown area are homeless-related. And he says HOT teams get a lot of calls directly from hospitals.
The hospitals say, hey, we've got a guy coming and going out of the emergency room every day, sometimes twice a day. But he's not listening to what we have to say. Can you guys find him on the street and try to intervene with him on the street? So if we can intervene with the person on the street and keep them from going to the hospital, that's a huge amount of savings to the hospital and to the community. And plus, it's better for the client.
One of the HOT teams has convinced a man named Joe to take a stab at treatment.
And I'm drunk 24/7. I'm drunk right now. It's really a hard life, man. I've been thinking of killing myself many times. I thought I'd try this one last time before I kill myself.
The HOT teams interface with people before they get arrested. San Diego police also run something called the SIP program. SIP helps chronic abusers that have run afoul of the law. Clients have to have multiple arrests for being drunk in public. They must have been taken by police to a detox center 5 times within 30 days. Sergeant Schnell says police give them a choice, jail or treatment.
So if the client opts to go to treatment instead of custody, we make that happen. We go back to court, we get the documents all filled out, we bounce the guy out of jail. San Diego Police Department actually picks the person up at jail and brings them down to St. Vincent de Paul Medical Center for a medical checkup. And then from there, we get them to where they need to go.
The clients go to detox centers or residential treatment facilities that may free them from the constant need for emergency medical care. Of course, getting someone into treatment is one thing. Getting them to complete it and stay sober is another. Gary Guerin used to live on the San Diego streets. Paramedics were called 36 times on his behalf in 1 3-month period. Guerin says he had his doubts about the SIP program.
Even the day that they came and picked me up from jail, I was ready to leave St. Vincent's when they took us there for the checkup and all. And I could have run out of there, and I thought about it. I wanted a cigarette, and I wanted a drink real bad.
But Guerin hung in there. He's been clean and sober for 2 years.
I've been in Orange County, L.A. County, Riverside, and San Bernardino, and San Diego County as a drunk. And to me, this is ideal. It's working for me, and I've seen it work for others.
The city and county of San Diego spend just over $200,000 a year for the SIP program and follow-up housing, a bargain compared to emergency care. and hospitals are reaping the savings. An evaluation of the SIP program found for people who entered treatment, their average use of medical services decreased by at least 50%. For Health Dialogues, I'm Kenny Goldberg in San Diego.
We're going to take a short break, and then in the second half of our show, what happens when parents using drugs can't kick their habit? And then, the epidemic of crystal meth addiction in the gay community. You're listening to Health Dialogues.
Next month on Health Dialogues, we look at food safety in California. Recent scares over tainted peanut butter and spinach exposed holes in the system protecting the food supply. How do we know what's safe to eat? And what's being done to keep our food free from disease? Food safety on the August edition of Health Dialogues.
Welcome back to Health Dialogues. I'm Scott Schaefer, and this hour we're looking at addictions and substance abuse and the costs associated with them. In the first half of the show, we heard about a program helping women overcome their addictions, but the results of treatment programs are mixed. And for parents addicted to drugs, there is the risk of losing those underage kids to foster care. One of the last stops before that happens is juvenile dependency court, where judges make life-changing decisions about whether to remove a child from a home. Catherine Lucero is supervising judge in Santa Clara County's Juvenile Dependency Court.
We hear cases where the Department of Family and Children Services have intervened in the form of either a Child Protective Services call or some other response to something that's happened in the community where the parent is either not available or has harmed the child directly, or it's been determined that the authorities need to intervene in the life of the child because the family is no longer a safe place that promotes the child's welfare. So that's the context of which a family comes in. The family has to be brought in. There's a petition lodged by the county agency, which is the Department of Family and Children Services.
And so in some cases, have children already been taken away from this person or these people?
Often that is the case. In a small percentage of cases, there's what's called an out-of-custody petition filed where I will be looking at supervising the family with the child in the home. But that's not generally – usually there's been an emergency of sorts, either an on-view emergency that has been documented by a police officer or a social worker, or I've issued a protective custody warrant because I've determined that based on some facts that the child is at risk and needs to be removed from the home.
And how often are drugs involved in one way or another?
You know, statistically, there are good national statistics. There are good California statistics, which show anywhere between 60 and 80% substance abuse related. In my county itself, we've done some data crunching within our various departments, and we now have four judges doing this work. It looks like it's about 65 to 80% of our cases are substance abuse related.
And say what that relationship is, you know, what how is it that the drugs are related to the fact that they're before you?
It could be anywhere from a baby being born addicted to methamphetamine at the hospital, and there's a call to CPS because the baby and the mom are both drug addicted at the time of birth, and there are some other issues going on, perhaps homelessness, perhaps documented family violence, perhaps documented CPS history.
CPS, Child Protective
Child
Services.
Child Protective Services history to an arrest in the community in the middle of the night where the family has been brought to the attention of the authorities and both parents are arrested either for possession or under the influence, to a child not attending school regularly, being brought to the attention of the authorities, and perhaps later there's a discovery that there's very serious problems at home that may or may not be related to drugs, to a child swallowing drugs accidentally. We have toddlers that pick drugs up off the carpet and end up in the emergency room full of methamphetamine or PCP or other dangerous drugs, and there's calls to the authorities. Our kids range from 0 to 18, and now with actually recent legislation, we're even keeping kids up until 21.
Are there kids who are before you, or is it the parents that you're dealing with?
The whole family is before us. But the reason why the family is before us is because the child becomes a dependent of the Santa Clara County Superior Court, which is the reason why we're called dependency court in this state. Other states call it other things, but we call it dependency court. For just everyone's common reference, it's child abuse court or foster care court.
And so the bottom line is that you have to make a decision that is going to affect where these kids end up. Is that right?
Correct.
And so the choices before you are what?
The mandate is to return the child if the child has been removed, and reasonable efforts have to be made. And these are legislative findings, statutory findings, reasonable efforts have to be made to prevent or eliminate the need to remove the child. And then they have to be made to return the child to the home. In a very small percentage of cases, we don't end up having that mandate. Those are called bypass cases, but those are very few cases. In most cases, there's a mandate to return the child to the home after the disposition of the case.
But there are cases in which the children are taken away. Permanently.
Yes. In fact, the timelines are very strict. They're laid out by the federal government and then complemented by each state's statutes. And it's called the Adoption Safe Families Act. And then that gives us a 12 to 18 month timeline for the parent to sufficiently ameliorate the issues that cause them to come before the court. In California, the parent has 6 months to make significant progress on their case plan or the things that brought them into court, like drugs or violence, neglect, that kind of thing. That's for children 0 to 3. If the parent doesn't make significant progress and comply with the case plan, the court orders, and after that hearing, which is the 6 month hearing for a child 0 to 3, I can set what's called a permanency hearing in 120 days. So in as little as 10 months from the date of removal, a parent could find themselves in a hearing or a trial, literally fighting for their parental rights. Because at that hearing, I decide whether or not to terminate parental rights, place in a guardianship, or to place the child into long-term foster care, which would be rare. That third option would be rare because the child is 0 to 3.
In the cases where drugs are involved, you have to get somebody into treatment then. They have a very short window of time to get their act together, basically.
Yes.
So what are your options in terms of, like, where do you send them? How do you help them or order them to clean up their act?
The courts have literally almost become the last social safety net. At the courthouse, we have drug treatment assessors. And so we order them to go down the hall and get an assessment for substance abuse. And then the parent is directed to attend whatever level of treatment is necessary, residential, outpatient, meetings, testing. So what we do is we order parents into drug treatment, to parenting classes, visitation, that kind of thing. At court specifically, we have found that it's necessary to provide problem-solving court wraparound services. And we do have a dependency drug treatment court, and we have a family wellness court in Santa Clara County where the parent comes in for frequent reviews to make sure they're on track because they do have so little time to get their children back.
What effect are all these budget cuts that are either have already happened or maybe coming down the pipeline? What effect do those have on treatment options?
The effect is devastating. For example, right now we have one father who has been ordered to treatment, residential treatment, and he's number 50 on the waiting list. Sometimes our waiting list can be 3 to 4 months long, and when you have a timeline of 6 months, which we call the fast track cases, then that becomes a true dilemma for the court.
And so you have a parent who's using drugs or trying to stop perhaps on their own because they can't get into treatment. Mm-hmm. And where are the children during that period of time?
They're generally in foster care. In Santa Clara County, over half of our children are with relatives. So they're generally with relative foster care, and they are literally waiting for the family to figure out what's going to happen next with their family. If the child's old enough, they're completely aware that they're in foster care, and they're hopefully visiting their parents, and they're very much involved in the, you know, the court process.
And as you think about this, what's the line between the legal issues and the health or addiction issues or other kinds of social service-y kinds of issues? I mean, because many people view this as a health problem, but it's also a criminal problem. And, you know, how do you separate those things out?
The reason why I feel so strongly about having our problem-solving courts around substance abuse using parents, one, is because we have such a high success rate. 76% of our families reunify in our drug treatment court versus 43% who don't reunify. In our dependency drug court, we do have mental health access for the parent, psychiatric medication access. We have housing support. We have resource development. We have vocational training. Our parents who get to dependency court generally don't have access to health care of any sort. More often than not, our mothers do end up pregnant with a second, third, fourth child while they're waiting for treatment in my court, while they're waiting to get their first baby back. I've had cases. In fact, I have a case with me today just that I pulled and wanted to look at some of the facts. It was her eighth child. And so this becomes a very serious health issue, not only for that parent, but also for the children who are being born drug addicted because of the lack of, quick and timely intervention.
Several years ago, voters here passed Prop 36, which mandates treatment instead of jail time in many instances when someone is using drugs. What effect has that had, do you think, on drug courts and on the state of families who are, you know, in a situation like the ones you're describing?
I think that it's had a positive effect on families, and treatment is what's warranted if it's a nonviolent substance abuse case. It's smart. It fits the medical model of substance abuse. It saves county dollars. Millions of dollars are saved with the drug court model. We have about a 33 to 35% overlap of our parents in both courts. So the Prop 36 problem-solving court model has really been positive. And I know that with the budget cuts, that is very threatened.
You've been doing this now for how many years?
I've been in the child maltreatment field in earnest for about the last 10 years.
And how has all that experience and all the families you've seen, how has it changed the way you think about addiction and drug issues generally?
What I know is I see people heal with the drug court model. I see people, I often say I see people rise from the dead. Because they come in, and we probably should take pictures of what they look like when they come in. And they come back to life because they are given access to true justice, which is access to treatment, access to health care, access to an ability to be the parent that they really do want to be, but for falling into the disease of addiction.
Judge Lucero, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Catherine Lucero is the supervising judge in Santa Clara County's Juvenile Dependency Court. As we heard earlier in the show, California has one of the highest rates of methamphetamine use in the nation. And it's safe to say that no drug causes more damage in the gay community. It's commonly known as crystal meth, speed, or Tina, and it's been a popular party drug among gay men since the 1990s. A 2008 survey showed that in California, the use of crystal meth was 11 times more common among gay men than in the rest of the state. It's also linked to unsafe sex and the spread of HIV. To combat the crystal meth epidemic in San Francisco's gay community, Michael Seaver started the Stonewall Project 12 years ago. Today, he's director of behavioral health sciences, health services at the San Francisco AIDS Foundation, and he's with us now. Also joining us is a recovering meth user, and we're going to call him by his first name, Danny. Good to have you as well.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Let me begin with you, Michael, if I could. Tell us, what kinds of problems does meth cause in the gay community?
Well, I mean, you know, some of the problems are true of many addictions to many drugs, which are, you know, people losing their jobs, losing their housing, a lot of the consequences of addiction to any drug. In addition, methamphetamine is particularly problematic because of the impacts that it has on people's brains. So it has brain damage that happens from, you know, any sort of significant amount of methamphetamine use that takes a long time to recover because our brains actually take a long time to heal from any kind of damage. And then, you know, on top of that, as you mentioned in the introduction, gay men who use crystal meth are many times more likely to have or transmit or get HIV than people who don't. And so it's a huge public health problem because of its connection to the HIV epidemic.
And why is it so popular among gay men, do you think?
It's a drug that makes people feel, at least initially, feel wonderful, feel on top of the world, like they can do anything. It gives people huge amounts of energy so they can stay up all night long, dancing, having sex, playing, doing whatever they want to do, cleaning their house. There's, you know, it at least for most people initially seems like a wonderful drug, and gives you, you know, boundless energy. You know, over time that becomes less wonderful. But in the beginning, for most people, although I have to say that for some people, one of the things that I often say about crystal meth is what goes up must come down. And so for most people, the high is followed by what's called a crash, which is not particularly fun. You were, as much as you had, you know, felt like you were on top of the world, you feel like you're under the world as the drug wears off. And so for some people, that's enough that it dissuades them from getting involved in the drug very much anyway. But for people who decide that the high is worth it, you know, it is a highly addictive drug. It's a very powerful drug. It's relatively inexpensive. It's easily available. Like I said, it enables you to party all night long in a way that no other drug really does, because cocaine, although it's similar, you have to keep going back and taking more and more cocaine, whereas methamphetamine high lasts for many, many hours.
And Danny, tell us about your experience with meth. How did you start using it?
I first used crystal meth when I was 19 with friends, actually out dancing, and it was a way to stay up and keep the party going all night long, you know, dancing till 6 in the morning. And then that was when I was about 19. I'm 40 now. So along the way, I kept using it in that manner. And then I'd say about 5 years ago, it was introduced using it as in a fashion of smoking it. But actually, that's when the addiction really took off, a lot stronger hold, using it in a different fashion, and got tied more sexually. And it's interestingly enough, it kind of snuck up on me. I mean, I was using it once a year, and then once every 6 months, and then once a month, and then before I realized it, I was using it every weekend just to feel better or to connect with people, and that completely became my social outlet. All my friends and family and everyone, didn't matter. It was a matter of the weekend was coming, and it was time to get high and, you know, have a good time and feel better.
And what effect did it have on your friends and your family? Did they know what was going on?
Actually, I was really – work and friends, and most of my family didn't really know what was going on. I hit it very well. Friends that I used with, which became my inner circle, they, of course, kept telling me that, oh, everything's fine. You're just like us. You know, you don't have – there's nothing wrong with you. Well, of course, everyone that was important to me, like my family, they got pushed to the outside, and it just got worse and worse for me.
How did you know when you had a problem?
I always told myself if this started affecting my health or my work, that I would do something about it. And it started to. I mean, I've been HIV positive since I was 19. And
was that HIV infection while you were doing meth, do you know?
Ironically, yes. Even though I was just using it sparingly or just, like I said, to stay awake. But I was using a much riskier behavior. And this was back in 1988 when I was infected, you know, when there weren't many options for HIV treatment. So.
So let me just stop you. Sure, so you get infected with HIV, you're 19, you're 40 now.
Yeah.
And yet you said you would deal with this when it began affecting your health. Didn't HIV affect your health sooner than just very recently? I guess what I'm getting at is, was there a kind of a self-delusion that everything was fine?
Of course. Well, that's part of the drug. I mean, you want to quit because you want to take care better care of yourself, but you also want to chase that high. And you kind of – I was balancing, okay, how much can I damage my body and enjoy partying and also take care of it? And the more I used and like I said, the more people I associated with using it, you start feeling you're okay. But then, you know, the effects end up showing up when you go to your doctor and you start – you're seeing your numbers go down. You start having staph infections, you know, just behavioral, weird behavior at work. I mean, I wasn't noticing it as much at myself because I was using, obviously. But a few things happened that made me realize it's, wow, you know, it's time to look into a program to get recovered.
And Michael Sieber, is there something within the gay community that kind of creates almost a predisposition to this drug taking hold?
Well, I don't know that it's something within the gay community as much as, you know, it is kind of, at least initially, seems to be the perfect party drug. And, you know, so many gay men use the drug for dancing, for partying, for sex. It's a popular drug for that reason. And, you know, gay men, I don't know that gay men are intrinsically more into partying than anyone else in the world, but one of the differences, I think, sometimes is that since a lot of gay men don't have children, don't have relationships that keep them at home, that they're able to go out and party longer into their life than sometimes other people are.
And what about like self-esteem issues? I mean, could that be something that, you know, you feel better doing meth than if you're not feeling so good about yourself?
Well, yeah. The other part is that, you know, what life is like for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender folks is very difficult often, and had very difficult childhood experiences, and that carries into your adulthood. And one of the things that we see all the time for the guys who come to the Stonewall Project is that they're carrying with them a lot of internalized heterosexism, homophobia, feelings that they're not worth anything, you know, in large part because they're gay. A lot of hang-ups about sex and a lot of negative feelings about the sex that they like to have. And so all of those things, you know, predispose someone to using a drug that will make all that stuff go away.
Mm. Was that true for you, Dan?
Oh, he hit the nail on the head. Actually, everything he was saying, I mean, feeling depression, feeling that you don't fit in, that you're different. We even feel that within the gay community among each other. And it seems like your inhibitions are lowered. All of a sudden, everyone's feeling, you know, everyone's invited to the party. You know, and I agree. It's easily, I think, in the gay community to get attached to this drug because you don't have a lot of connection to other people, and this helps you connect and make all your problems go away, at least initially.
And the unsafe sex comes from your judgment being impaired, I assume, or what is it?
For me, a lot of it was, you know, I knew better, but, you know, you're like, it's not that you don't care. It's like you feel like you're invincible. Or you put a lot of trust into the other person. I heard a lot where people say, oh, well, I asked him if he was negative and he said yes. Well, what does that really mean? Is he really negative or just not gotten tested? So you put a lot, they say, okay, well, he told me he wasn't. Well, it turns out he was and he infected me.
Hmm. And I think there's a whole issue of, I mean, in addition to sort of the mental health issues that I mentioned before, the whole issue of being part of a community that has been dealing with HIV for, you know, we're getting close to 30 years now, and having had devastating effects on the community and all the members of the community, and that obviously varies significantly depending on your age, but the whole ability of the drug in some ways to make that all go away also, to be able to pursue sex with careless abandon, which is something that we all kind of like to do when we can, you know, that HIV makes that pretty difficult. And you know, so when you suddenly discover a drug that suddenly makes all that go away and you don't really care and you're too high to really worry about it, this stuff, that's a very delightful and enticing thing.
And in terms of intervention, what works and what doesn't?
Well, one of the most important things I think to say is that treatment does work. One of the unfortunate things that has been in the media a lot is that a lot of questions about whether drug treatment works, and particularly the methamphetamine, for some reason, there have been lots of stories in the media seeming to indicate that methamphetamine addiction is intractable and untreatable, and none of that is true. That treatment, you know, there's lots of evidence that treatment works. It's not something that works quickly or easily. I mean, addiction, as I often say to some people, if addiction were easy to get over, we wouldn't call it an addiction. You know, that addiction treatment is often a very long term, or as someone mentioned earlier in the show, it's really a chronic condition that people have to deal with. And so I think some of the ideas that people have that it's not treatable have more to do with the fact that it's not something you can just take a pill and be better.
Yeah.
You know?
And Danny, what about for you? You're recovering now. What's worked for you to keep you away from meth?
A lot of it's behavior change, realizing who I can associate with, realizing my limits, and also not just going to meetings and trying to reestablish myself with a different community, and realizing that I'm not perfect, and if I do slip or have a relapse, that I'm still on the same path of getting better. It's a lot of work. I mean, I've been in recovery of any sort for about a year and a half now, and it's really helped me. It's really helped me a lot. You know, have I been perfect? No, I've definitely had my slips, but I realize that I learned from them, and I know I'm on the right path with recovery.
And Michael. I think, there's sort of, we've talked around a little bit, the isolation that comes with drug addiction and the isolation that a lot of people feel that gets them into drug addiction. And I think one of the things that's most significant in terms of treatment is getting people reconnected, getting people reintegrated into some kind of social fabric in their lives, because that's what keeps people on a path that that leads them toward health.
So they need support.
Yes.
Yeah. And we're short on time, but I'm just wondering this notion of harm reduction. I mean, Danny said that he hasn't been perfect. And, a few people, whether it's the president who smokes cigarettes or any number of other addictions people have, I mean, how do you balance that desire to be clean and sober with the reality that sometimes, people are people?
Well, I think just the way you said it, that, even if your desire is to be abstinent from drugs, getting there may be very difficult. And I think one of the problems that we try to overcome in harm reduction is the judgment and the shame that comes with slipping. That I know very few people who are able to decide that they wanted to stop doing drugs and able to do that, turn on a dime and do that without any problems, without any slips. And so what we try to do from a harm reduction perspective is be very caring and loving and accepting the fact that, this is a struggle and you're going to stumble sometimes and you're going to fall sometimes. And the important thing is that you figure out how to pick yourself up.
And Danny, just a few seconds left here, but what advice do you have for someone who might be listening and knows they have a problem with crystal meth and wants to do something about it? What would you tell them?
That they're not alone, that there are a lot of people, there are a lot of friends and programs and family that are very supportive out there. And, if you really want to get better and you're willing to work hard, you can. So,
anything to add to that, Michael?
Just that, there are lots of places that you can go for help. We at the San Francisco AIDS Foundation have any number of programs that can be helpful for people, but there are many others in the city. The issue is always funding and having availability of services, but there are places to go.
And there is a website that you work with, tweaker.org.
Tweaker.org is one of our websites. There's also stonewallsf.org. There's also the San Francisco AIDS Foundation website. There's lots of information on all of those.
All right. Well, thanks to both of you very much, Michael Siever and Danny. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's all the time we have for today. Thanks to all of our guests for joining us this hour. And don't forget, everything you just heard and much more is available on our website, including a link to a youth radio story about TV addiction. You can listen to our show, subscribe to the podcast, even suggest your own topic ideas, and of course, get involved in the conversation. It's all there right now at healthdialogues.org. Tune in for next month's Health Dialogues when we're talking about food safety. Health Dialogues is a production of the California Report and KQED Public Radio. Seal Muller is at the controls today. The Health Dialogues team includes Susie Racho, Polly Stryker, Gabriel Cohen, Nick Vidinsky, Erica Kelly, Tao Nguyen, Shuka Kalantari, and Julieta Kuznir. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report's Health Dialogue series are provided by the California Endowment, working to build healthier communities that support children, youth, and families. online at www.calendow.org, and the members of KQED Public Radio.